in the fall of 1958, I had been at a house party held by one of my classmates, and we were getting overly friendly, but it was not, I don't want to imply that that may have been sexual. We were just, dancing close and may have kissed or something, but nothing more than that. And she was going steady with someone else who took exception to my behavior. By the time I got home that night, my father had waited up for me to come home, and it was quite late. It was probably at 2 or 2:30 in the morning. And my dad told me, there was a guy here looking for you, and described the car that the guy was in, and I knew it was the car driven by this woman's boyfriend. And I said to Dad, "Don't worry about it. It'll pass. It's nothing." And I stayed in what would be considered today an in-law apartment, aside from the house, as separate from the main house. So I was in bed in my boxer shorts, and there was a knock on the door. I knew immediately who it was, and I got up and I opened the door, and this guy came in. This was the woman's boyfriend. I shut the door, and then we had words, and I don't know what those words were, and wouldn't even attempt to paraphrase them, that they were exactly what you might expect that conversation to have been. And a fight ensued. And I don't remember if I punched him first or he swung at me, whatever, but I punched him and he went down to his knees, and when he did, he grabbed a hold of my genitalia and was holding on. And just a minute amount of panic ran through my body as I began to just start punching his head. And at that moment, the main door of that apartment I was in just imploded. It wasn't that the door came loose or opened. It came right off the hinges. That door imploded and came right down. And a big man came through that door carrying a knife. And I could see in that man's face, in his eyes, that man was devoid of an immortal soul. That man was on just a different plane than. It was terrifying just to look at him. I'd never seen him before, never met him. I don't know that I'd ever heard of him at that time. His name was Arthur Lee Allen.
Everybody, welcome back to the second episode of Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host, Ryan Corrales, and today we're going to dive deep into an examination of the Zodiac, whose identity still remains unknown, despite the passing of nearly 50 years since his last confirmed victim. In fact, the Zodiac is arguably America's most infamous serial killer, having been the subject of, and not to mention inspiration for, countless books, movies, investigative series, magazine articles, and podcasts. So, for anybody who isn't familiar with this maniac, he would be best described as a serial killer who spread fear throughout the San Francisco Bay Area from 1968 through 69, yet most likely claimed victims as early as 63, perhaps until 74 or later. He became notorious when survivors of his attacks were able to describe being approached by a man carrying a 9mm handgun and a knife, clad in a black executioner's hood with the crosshairs of a Zodiac symbol on the bib. Now, what I find truly fascinating about this case is that there is a mountain of circumstantial evidence to suggest that a few of the scumbags in the short list of suspects are guilty, but nothing more. There is no concrete physical evidence to link the killings to any one particular person. Yet we have a multitude of reasons to believe that even the men who have been seemingly eliminated as suspects by way of such means as DNA might still be guilty. It's in that gray area where this case continues to thrive, where it mixes the magic potion that keeps amateur and professional sleuths alike following the scent. I mean, I think this whole element has pretty strong ties to America's fascination with serial killers as a whole. specifically the notion that the technological advances of the 20th century created a golden age, if you will, that rendered a showdown between advancing investigative techniques and elusive murderers utilizing cold, brutal tactics that left traces of their identities flirting with us, but never a name or a face. It is this element of not knowing the face of evil, of suspecting your neighbor, your priest, or even your hairstylist, that elevates these events to iconic status. It is the self-deification of man, of a flesh and blood being declaring himself God, that tantalizes our souls with the horrors of what might wait for us in the light at the end of the tunnel. This is what makes the Zodiac so alluring, so frightful, and quite frankly, so powerful in his rapturous messages and ciphers he sent to police. So, let's jump into the crimes in the first part of the show, and then move on to an in-depth discussion of the top suspects that continue to be on everybody's radar. I'll focus on the victims that are clearly the work of the Zodiac, but also touch upon a few other murders that fit the killer's profile, yet were never confirmed as the work of the Zodiac. The starting point is the Lake Herman Road attack on December 20th, 1968, aptly named for the location in which it took place. This is commonplace for the Zodiac killings involving young couples, to be known specifically by their locations rather than the victims involved. It's likely because there were a couple of attacks where one of the two victims survived, and therefore the crime couldn't be labeled as the so-and-so murders or similar. So, on this night, high school students David Faraday and Betty Lou Jensen headed out on their first date. Apparently, they were going to a Christmas-themed concert at their high school, which is approximately 3 blocks from Jensen's home in Benicia. But plans suddenly changed. The young couple instead visited one of their friends and then went to a local restaurant, where a discussion likely ensued that left them agreeing to go to a turnout by Lake Herman Road that was frequently used as a lover's lane type of parking lot by teens in the area. So, Faraday pulls his Rambler to a halt in the gravel lot around 10:15 p.m. that night, and we assume the young couple gets down to business at this point. They were two young lovers, alone in a car with the excitement of a new romantic interest by each of their sides, somebody with whom to explore the future, even if it was just making out in a car for a half hour. Which it was. By 11 p.m., their dead bodies are discovered by a woman named Stella Borges, a nearby Solano County resident. Police had no immediate leads as to how the crimes transpired, but later forensic evidence would suggest a second car pulled into the lot next to the Rambler, where a man got out with a gun and ordered the young couple to exit their car. Faraday was shot in the head while getting out of the vehicle, at which point police believe Betty Lou Jensen took off running. The Zodiac responded by shooting her in the back 5 times, and she fell to her death in the gravel nearly 30 feet away from the Rambler. The killer then got in his car and drove off. In the aftermath, the sheriff's department investigated the crime, but came up empty. And this is where we don't hear from the Zodiac again until months later, on July 4th, 1969, just prior to midnight, when local waitress Darlene Farron and Michael McGough are attacked at Blue Rock Springs in Vallejo, which is only 4 miles from where the previous murders took place. And here we have similar circumstances, with the victims being young lovers parked with the intention of a little harmless fooling around. Undoubtedly, the two of them are having a great time. Until a second car pulls into the lot and parks next to Farron's car. But nobody gets out. In fact, the vehicle pulls away into darkness almost immediately. It disappears. 10 minutes later, the vehicle returns, and this time the driver parks behind the young couple, in much the same manner a cop would. But this is no cop. Aside from a flashlight, which he points directly in the eyes of the young couple, the mysterious man is also gripping a 9mm Luger pistol, a popular German sidearm during World War II, and more importantly, generally not a police-issued weapon or something that would even be considered practical for a cop. Then it happens. As the man approaches the car, 5 shots crack from the barrel of the weapon. McGough is hit several times, blocking Farron from fire. However, a few bullets pass right through his body and into Farron. At this point, satisfied the victims are deceased, the killer walks away toward his car. But Michael McGough suddenly moans in agony, so the madman walks back to the car and pumps 2 more slugs into each of his prey. 45 minutes later, at 12:40 a.m. on July 5th, 1969, an unidentified man calls the Vallejo Police Department to not only claim responsibility for this attack, but also the deadly assault on David Faraday and Betty Lou Jensen in Benicia just prior to Christmas the previous year. The Vallejo cops were able to trace the call and learned it was placed from a payphone at a gas station only blocks from the police department. Unfortunately, the satisfied killer was long gone by this point, but what he didn't know is that Michael Mago survived the attack, even after being shot in the chest, neck, and face. In 1991, over two decades later, he would identify his shooter definitively in a lineup of police photos. And the man he chose? Arthur Lee Allen, a former school teacher whose name had already been at the top of the suspect list. Much more on him later. Plus, the location was less than a half mile from Darlene Farron's home. And again, I think this correlates to the mysticism of serial killers in the 20th century, who were often shrouded in mystery as they were able to taunt authorities and elude capture for extended periods, sometimes never being caught or dying in prison for convictions on other crimes. It's often noted how lucky the Zodiac must have been to not be positively identified by any of the witnesses in his crimes, especially during the mix-up that took place when he slaughtered taxi driver Paul Stein in his cab on the streets of San Francisco, which we'll cover shortly. I mean, if we place some of the Zodiac killings in the context of today's technology, he'd have been identified 10 times over by smartphones, security cameras, dash cams, and so on. But this was the late 1960s. An advantage was to the killer. So, at this point, Zodiac, who has yet to publicize himself with the aforementioned moniker, has three confirmed kills and also critically injured another person. The police realize pretty quickly there's a connection between the two incidents, even if disagreements arise as how to pursue the investigation. The killer's MO is fairly clear with the knowledge of his preference to target young couples with a pistol as they sit parked in their cars at night. But the Zodiac threw them a curveball, and what followed is perhaps his most famous and horrific crime. Something happens first, though. A twist that would take the killer's taunting to the next level and literally promise to reveal his identity. On August 1st, 1969, the San Francisco Examiner, Vallejo Times Herald, and San Francisco Chronicle each receive a letter that was supposedly from the killer. At first glance, each of the letters appear to be the same and claim responsibility for the attacks not only at Lake Herman Road, but also Blue Rock Springs. In each of the letters was one-third of a 408-symbol cryptogram that the killer promised would reveal his identity when solved. He demanded each be printed on the front page of the respective newspapers to which they were sent, or else he would, quote, cruise around all weekend, killing lone people in the night, then move on to kill again, until I end up with a dozen people over the weekend, end quote. While the Chronicle compromised and published the letter on page 4, that article also featured a quote from the Vallejo police chief that they weren't convinced the letters were authentic, and he requested a second letter be sent. Ultimately, all three letters were published with the killer's mysterious ciphers, and he did not cruise around all weekend murdering people. Then, on August 7th, the Examiner actually receives a response in the form of a letter in which the killer finally proclaims, quote, Dear Editor, this is the Zodiac speaking. The text includes details about his crimes that were not available to the public, and he boldly claims that when the police crack the cipher, they'll have his identity. So, one would have to think this cryptogram would intentionally be nearly impossible to crack. And what incentive does the killer have to expose himself? But the very next day, on August 8, 1969, while top experts were still unable to decode the message, school teachers Donald and Betty Hardin of Salinas, California, managed to do just that. Apparently, Donald had some experience cracking codes while a student at the University of Florida years earlier. What resulted was a paragraph of misspelled ramblings from the killer, which I'll read to you now. Quote, I like killing people because it is so much fun. It is more fun than killing wild game in the forest because man is the most dangerous animal of all. To kill something gives me the most thrilling experience. It is even better than getting your rocks off with a girl. The best part of it is that when I die, I will be reborn in paradise, and they I have killed will become my slaves. I will not give you my name because you will try to slow down or stop my collection of slaves from my afterlife. And this ends with another set of symbols, which is 18 letters long, but has never been cracked to this day. So to this day, the meaning of the last 18 letters remains unknown. And while many believe they contain the killer's name, and that justifies the difficulty of decoding that section, others believe it's little more than a distraction, or possibly even a mistake in the killer's construction of that part of the message that renders it gibberish when translated. Of course, the police were deflated upon learning they didn't have their man's identity, and the Zodiac's musing in the decoded text that he would not reveal himself was taken at face value by most people, and for decades at that. But there is something very interesting in that cipher that perhaps does reveal the man's name, a mini-cipher within the larger one. And in a case that is fueled by circumstantial evidence, it's quite damning. That is, depending upon who your number one pick is among the potentially guilty parties. Now, we'll circle back to that point when the man in question arrives on our suspect list. But at this point, the Zodiac disappears for the remainder of August 1969, and most of the following month as well. Then, on September 27th, 1969, he unleashes what is perhaps his most notorious and brutal attack on the shores of Lake Berryessa. Once again, he targets two young lovers, college students Brian Hartnell and Cecilia Shepherd, but this time in broad daylight, with the murder weapon being a knife. Now, I'm going to ask you to just pause here for a moment and picture yourself in their shoes. You're young, the future is bright, it's a beautiful day, and you're alone with the person you'd most want to be with. Then, very suddenly, some guy approaches from the tree line wearing military-style boots, a black executioner's hood with clip-on sunglasses over the eyes, and a matching black bib that comes down over his chest and has the circle with crosshair Zodiac symbol on the front. He's holding a .45 caliber handgun and a foot-long knife. So, I don't know about you, and perhaps I have the luxury of viewing this with a more rational approach than did the victims, but my immediate impression would be that this man's intention is to kill me. He isn't dressed in a manner that would suggest otherwise, especially with Halloween still over a month away. But he feeds the couple a story about how he escaped from a prison in Montana and needs their car and some money to get to Mexico. He has pre-cut lengths of plastic clothesline with him and wants Cecilia Shepherd to tie up Brian Hartnell before he ties her up. At this point, the couple is just thinking it's a very odd sort of robbery, but they comply in hopes that they're right and the man will flee once they've been tied. But he doesn't. In fact, he reties Hartnell's hands behind his back and then binds Shepherd as well. Of course, they're urging him to take their stuff and leave. But he doesn't. He draws the knife, straddles each of them, and plunges the blade into their backs repeatedly as they scream and beg for their lives. When it's over, he hikes back up the Knoxville Road, where Hartnell's car was parked. And I still get chills every time I think about what happens next. The Zodiac uses a felt-tip pen to draw his crosshair symbol on the car door. And beneath it, he writes, Vallejo, 12-20-68, 7-4-69, September 27-69, 6:30, by knife. And just like that, he disappears. But Hartnell and Shepherd aren't dead. The madman leaves them to bleed out, and their cries are heard by a local fisherman out on the lake with his son. That's when they contact the park rangers. Napa County Sheriff's deputies Dave Collins and Ray Land arrive shortly thereafter. And this is when Cecilia Shepherd gives an incredibly detailed description of her attacker that has become nothing less than iconic in the decades since. What made this so important was that they finally had a face to put to the Zodiac name. But the reality is that this description would later conflict with what other eyewitnesses saw, and that ultimately led to notions of copycat killers and even the possibility that the Zodiac disguised his appearance beyond wearing a hood. What should have been a leg up for police almost instantly garnered more confusion in false leads than they had experienced prior to having the description. To this day, the sketch compiled from her description bears no resemblance whatsoever to any of the top suspects in the case. In fact, a plethora of men whose descriptions fit this sketch have been suggested publicly as the killer, despite no correlation of physical evidence beyond their appearance from the neck up. This is the amazing psychological effect the killer had on society, how he terrorized the masses while actually killing so few. He was anybody and everybody, all at once. Regardless, Pacific Union College student Cecilia Shepherd falls into a coma on the ride to the hospital, and she passes away 2 days later. Brian Hartnell survives the attack, despite being viciously stabbed in the back 8 times. Now, I have to admit I was curious about what became of Hartnell's little Carmen Ghia, especially the door with the Zodiac's writing on it. While I can't account for the whereabouts of the vehicle, supposedly the door is still in the evidence locker at the Napa County Sheriff's Office. And yes, I know it's a disturbing and perhaps irresponsible consideration, but can you imagine how much that might be worth on eBay? Looking ahead from the Lake Berryessa attacks, the Zodiac doesn't waste much time in claiming another victim. This time it's 29-year-old San Francisco cab driver Paul Stein, who picked up the killer at Mason and Geary Streets and drove him into Washington and Maple in Presidio Heights, arriving only minutes before 10 p.m. Upon reaching the destination, the Zodiac reveals a 9mm pistol that he uses to shoot the driver in the head. The killer then takes Stein's wallet and car keys, and for reasons unknown at the time, also tears off a piece of the man's bloodied shirt. 3 teens across the street witness the crime taking place, and immediately phone police to say the man wiped down the cab and walked off north. Officer Don Falk responded to the call and noticed a suspicious white male walking up some steps to a house only 2 blocks from the crime scene. In a chilling turn of events, we later learned that this was the Zodiac, but the cops dismissed him after only seconds of conversation because the radio dispatcher had inexplicably advised them to be on the lookout for a black male suspect. To this day, there's no explanation for the mix-up, but I think we can safely assume the crime was not immediately considered the work of the Zodiac. It was a single victim in an urban location, and robberies of cab drivers resulting in murder is a crime as common and old as the existence of cabs themselves. So, why then did the Zodiac take a swath of the tail from Paul Stein's shirt? Well, because 3 days later, on October 14th, 1969, the San Francisco Chronicle receives another letter with the bloodied article of clothing accompanying it in the envelope, so as to preclude the police from any attempt at suggesting the communication was inauthentic. Once again, as in his last letter, the Zodiac dishes out a threat of violence that's a major escalation from any of his actual murders. This time the intended target is schoolchildren, as he states he would attack a bus and, quote, just shoot out the front tire and then pick off the kiddies as they come bouncing out, end quote. This anecdote obviously did not receive a welcome greeting from the general public, and subsequently the police were forced to expend even more resources in an effort to catch the bad guy, despite the fact he didn't follow through on his claim in the previous letter either. So, this is when San Francisco detectives Bill Armstrong and Dave Toski are brought onto the case, in what eventually becomes one of the more prolific manhunts in American history. In all, the SFPD will investigate more than 2,500 suspects over the course of decades. Yet Paul Stein's murder remains unsolved. On October 20th, 1969, at 2 p.m., only 6 days after the aforementioned letter arrives at the Chronicle, somebody calls the Oakland police and claims to be the Zodiac. He demands that either F. Lee Bailey or Melvin Belli, both attorneys, appear on the local TV show AM San Francisco. Bailey, who later rose to stardom as part of O.J. Simpson's defense team, and previously had defended the Boston Strangler, Albert DeSalvo, wasn't available at the time, but Melvin Belli agreed. During the show, host Jim Dunbar receives several calls from a man named Sam who claims to be the Zodiac. After speaking with the man, Belli agrees to meet with him, but the man never shows. Weeks later, on November 8th, 1969, another Zodiac letter is received, this time containing a 340-symbol cipher that has not been decoded to this day. The very next day, the Zodiac taunts police with another letter that reveals what they had already suspected. Two of their own encounter the Zodiac right after the Paul Stein shooting, but let him walk. In the killer's own words, quote, "Two cops pulled a goof about 3 minutes after I left the cab. I was walking down the hill to the park when this cop car pulled up, and one of them called me over and asked if I saw anyone acting suspicious or strange in the last 5 to 10 minutes. And I said yes, there was this man who was running by waving a gun. And the cops peeled rubber and went around the corner as I directed them. And I disappeared into the park a block and a half away, never to be seen again." End quote. Then after a demand to print that section, he also writes, quote, "Hey, pig, doesn't it rile you up to have your nose rubbed in your boo-boos?" End quote. The Zodiac then goes on to suggest he's not actually going to pick off little kids with a gun as they exit a school bus. No, he says, he's going to build, quote, "a death machine, a bomb made of ammonium nitrate fertilizer, stove oil, and other such goodies that he details like it's his grandmother's recipe for Southern biscuits and gravy." Then, in December, exactly 1 year after the murders of David Faraday and Betty Lou Jensen, the killer mails another piece of Paul Stein's shirt to lawyer Melvin Belli and claims he wants the man's help. And that's when the Zodiac goes dormant for a while, or so we believe due to his lack of communication. But on March 22, 1970, a young mother, Kathleen Johns, who was also 7 months pregnant, was driving home to Petaluma, California, from her mother's in San Bernardino, when she was stopped by another driver on 132 West near Modesto, who was behind her flashing his lights and honking his horn. When she pulls over, the man stops behind her, gets out, and says he notices the right rear wheel on her car is wobbling. He offers to tighten the lug nuts, and a few minutes later the woman thanks him as she goes on her way. But almost immediately the car starts driving strangely, and the wheel nearly falls off. The strange man then offers to drive Kathleen to the nearest gas station, an offer she accepts, unfortunately. But once the young woman and child get in the man's car, the man does little more than drive around endlessly near back roads for more than 90 minutes. And he passes a number of gas stations without stopping. When Ms. Johns repeatedly demands to know why he neglects to stop, he only ignores her or changes the subject. Afraid for her safety, the young woman finally jumps out of the car with her daughter when the Zodiac stops at an intersection. She then hides in a field as conflicting reports either have the killer driving away immediately or getting out of the car to search for his potential prey with a flashlight. For her sake, I hope it was the former. Afterward, Johns hitched a ride to the police station nearby Patterson, and here's where this gets really interesting. Kathleen Johns doesn't have a clue she's just been abducted by an infamous serial killer, but while giving a statement to the sergeant on duty at the station, she notices the sketch of Paul Stein's killer on the wall and immediately identifies the man as her attacker. I mean, just imagine being either of those two people at that moment. It must have been mind-blowing to come to the realization of what actually just took place. And then, upon returning to Kathleen's car to collect evidence, police find it torched. So, it's interesting to note that the Zodiac didn't claim a murder victim that day, even though he had ample opportunity. I think this is a great place in the chronology of events to stop and consider what might have changed in the Zodiac's life to precipitate the change to becoming merciful in this act. While the victims did escape, it almost seems as though that was his intention, as though he wasn't driving around looking for the right moment to kill, but doing so with the intention of the result that followed, letting the victims live. Even a cursory examination of the Zodiac timeline reveals that the nature, timing, and frequency of his crimes parallels his letters, with his most powerful messages accompanied by actual kills. As time goes on, and the killings dissipate, he becomes more desperate to be seen as something he isn't anymore. His threats get more ridiculous. His thoughts meander. He even goes so far as to tell the reporter who's getting his letters published that his life is in danger, all in an effort to be taken seriously. The one thing he won't do, however, at least not definitively and with accompanying proof as he had in the past, is kill. I believe many of the later Zodiac communications thought to be fake due to inconsistencies with previous communications by the killer were actually authentic, and our ignorance is that we hadn't realized the person had changed. He was still desperate. He still wanted attention. But he could no longer kill. Notice during this time that his claims seem to be increasingly embellished, at least as it pertains to his total number of kills, yet none of them are ever confirmed as they had been in the past. At one point, he boasts 37 victims. But who are they? We'll examine this subject further once we arrive at the suspects. But back to the crimes. There were no confirmed Zodiac kills in 1970, but the killer ramps up his communication to police and the press. Of particular note is a 13-character cipher that is preceded by the words, quote, "My name is blank," which is never definitively solved, but matches the length of a man's name who would later become a top suspect, and whose name also allegedly appears in translation from a key in the Zodiac's infamous 408-symbol cipher that had previously been cracked by the Salinas, California couple. Then, on April 28th, Zodiac sends a greeting card to the Chronicle in which he threatens to bomb a bus, then requests the people of San Francisco start wearing Zodiac buttons, a demand for which he was obviously not indulged. And there's reason to believe there might have been retribution. On June 19th, SFPD Sergeant Richard Ratatich was shot in the head with a .38 caliber weapon while writing a parking ticket in his squad car. A week after the murder, Zodiac sends a letter to the Chronicle expressing his disappointment that he doesn't see anybody wearing his buttons and states, quote, "I shot a man sitting in a parked car with a .38," end quote. And this is after a previous letter denying he bombed a police station included a note that he felt, quote, "There is more glory to killing a cop than a kid, because a cop can shoot back," end quote. To this day, however, the San Francisco Police Department claims the shooting was not the work of the Zodiac, and the case remains unsolved. But the Zodiac continues to keep busy that summer. On July 24th, 1970, the killer claims responsibility for the abduction of Kathleen Johns and her young daughter 4 months earlier. 2 days later, he's writing to the Chronicle again, referencing a threat of a bomb placed on Mount Diablo, one of numerous bombing threats from the Zodiac that never comes to fruition. Then in October of the same year, the Chronicle receives a 3x5 card with 13 holes punched in it, each to signify a victim. It was marked with the crosshairs of the Zodiac and supposedly drawn in blood. On the 24th of the same month, the reporter at the Chronicle assigned to the case, Paul Avery, receives a Halloween card signed with the killer's crosshair symbol and the words, "Peekaboo, you are doomed." The story makes the front page of the paper, and the killer continues his meteoric rise to stardom. Yet he is still nothing more than a phantom, a shadow in the night. Despite sketches comprised from key eyewitnesses to his crimes, there was simply no face to put to the man. But everything changed in the aftermath of Avery's story. At this point, the reporter receives an anonymous letter tipping him off about the eerie similarities between the Zodiac killings and a murder that took place 4 years earlier down the coast in Southern California. On October 30th, 1966, 18-year-old Riverside College student Sherry Jo Bates studied at a campus library until it closed around 9 p.m. The next morning, her body is found beaten, bruised, and full of stab wounds, located between two rundown houses that were scheduled to be demolished. Her car is nearby. Wires have been pulled from the distributor cap to disable the vehicle. A man's Timex watch with a torn band is found at the scene. The time stopped at 12:24. However, authorities believe the crime occurred much earlier, especially in light of the fact neighbors reported hearing a scream around 10:30 p.m. And here's where we get to the little clues that slowly begin to coagulate from a muddled array of vicious ramblings to form the basis for identifying a faceless killer. We learned that 1 month after Bates was killed, two separate typewritten letters were sent to the Riverside Police and the Riverside Press Enterprise entitled The Confession. Much like the early Zodiac crimes, the person who wrote this letter divulged intimate details that would only be common to the killer and police, in order to confirm he was indeed the guilty party. Its author asserted that Bates, quote, was not the first and she will not be the last, end quote. The next month, on December 29th, 1966, a disturbing poem is discovered on the underside of a desk at Riverside City College, and a 1970 investigation into the Zodiac produced striking similarities to his handwriting. Leading document expert Sherwood Morrill would later claim that it was likely the killer's work. And in fact, Arthur Lee Allen admits to having been in the area at the time. And this is when it gets even more personal. The killer's taunting extends to the victim's family when Riverside Police, the local newspaper, and Sherry Jo Bates' father, Joseph, each receive nearly identical letters effectively stating that the girl had to die and there will be more killings to come. While Joseph's copy had no signature, the other two were signed with a strange symbol that was thought by some to be the letter Z, while others thought it was a unique manner of writing the number 32. To my eyes, it looks like both. Either way, both the letter and the number would come to bear great significance in the case, even if they remained circumstantial in nature throughout. It isn't difficult to see the killer's intention might have been to combine the letter and number, as the man who would soon become the number one suspect in the Zodiac case had been 32 years old when Bates was murdered and also lived at a street address which was number 32. Now, Paul Avery subsequently wrote an article linking the Zodiac to the murder and response by the killer, which was penned in a letter to the Los Angeles Times, gives credit to the police for digging up the story. This was an obvious jab at Avery, and the Zodiac also adds, quote, but they're only finding the easy ones. There are a hell of a lot more down there, end quote. So, back to 1970, the police and Avery have their doubts about the Zodiac as Sherry Jo Bates' killer back in 66. They're unsure if he actually committed the crime or just took credit in the aftermath once it was attributed to him. To this day, Bates' murder, one in which she was nearly decapitated, remains unsolved. So, the Zodiac remains somewhat quiet during the period that follows, until March 22, 1971, when he sends a postcard to Paul Avery that appears to claim responsibility for the disappearance of Donna Lass, a casino employee in the Lake Tahoe area who'd been missing for months. The card includes a collage of pictures featuring the Forest Pines condominiums, the text Sierra Club, and several phrases intended to perhaps give a generalized location of where the body could be found. Police ultimately search the grounds of the Sierra Club and discover what seems to be a gravesite. But an excavation only uncovers a pair of sunglasses. Furthermore, on the day Lass disappeared, an unknown male called her employer and landlord to claim the young woman had left town due to a family emergency. In the end, however, there was simply no definitive link to the iconic killer. Moving ahead, in late 1972, a Vallejo Times Herald story suggests the 1963 murders of high school seniors Robert Domingos and fiancée Linda Edwards in northern Santa Barbara County were the early work of the Zodiac. Similarities to Zodiac crimes included the fact that they were two young lovers in a secluded location who the killer held at gunpoint and demanded to tie each other up. After getting free of their restraints, they tried to run and were shot in the back and chest with a .22 caliber weapon. Now, the Zodiac had been silent during this time period. It remained so until January 29, 1974, when his final confirmed letter arrived at the Chronicle. In it, he praised the new hit horror film The Exorcist as the best satirical comedy he'd ever seen, before concluding the text with a declaration of his total number of kills at 37. And while there were more letters to come, and it would be fair to say they never stopped, this was the last to receive a general consensus as being authentic. Later letters were often considered fakes and forgeries, even to the extent that author Armistead Maupin claimed one of them closely resembled fan mail he'd received from Zodiac investigator and SFPD detective Dave Toski a few years earlier. Countless people have come forward to suggest their brother, uncle, grandfather, and half the other men they know are the real Zodiac. But his true identity remains unknown. So, here we get to the suspects. When it comes to putting a face to the Zodiac killer, there's an enormous amount of circumstantial evidence to suggest the maniac is almost certainly former military misfit and fired elementary school teacher turned child molester Arthur Lee Allen. That is, except his face. Because he didn't match any of the police sketches drawn from the direct suggestions of eyewitnesses to his crimes, even the victims themselves, as was the case with Cecilia Shepherd, who literally gave her detailed description of the man as she died from his attack with a foot-long knife. The three teens who saw Paul Stein murdered in his cab on the streets of San Francisco? They also didn't describe Allen either. And Officer Don Falk, who ran into him only minutes later, said that the man he saw was probably 100 pounds smaller than Arthur Lee Allen. But Blue Rock Springs survivor Michael McGough, who was shot several times, was certain Allen was the man he encountered that fateful night. And Brian Hartnell, who survived the Lake Berryessa attack where Cecilia Shepherd died after giving that description of the killer, was later introduced to Allen by police at his place of work and said his voice and physical build matched the Zodiac. So, who was the Zodiac? Let's take a look at the top suspects. Number one, Ted Kaczynski. Yes, that's right, folks. The infamous Unabomber himself was a Zodiac suspect, though it isn't clear if the connection goes further than the fact he lived in Northern California at the time, constructed bombs, and communicated with the cops about crimes. It's interesting, but I think we'll pass him over in favor of number two, Richard Gajkowski. While I have to state that I believe wholeheartedly that Arthur Lee Allen was the Zodiac, the circumstantial evidence surrounding this man is compelling to an extent that it warrants further examination. To say the least, during the Zodiac's reign of fear over the Bay Area in the late 1960s and early 70s, Richard Gajkowski, a.k.a. Dick Gajk, and several other variations of that same name, wrote for a counterculture newspaper in San Francisco called Good Times, which was supposedly also a commune. Now, Gajkowski's circumstantial relationship with this case begins around 1966, when he moves east to Albany, New York, right after eventual Blue Rock Springs shooting victim Darlene Ferrin does so upon getting married. Gajkowski ends up working in the same building as her husband, and for a rival newspaper. 4 years after Darlene's murder, in 1973, a suspected Zodiac letter sent to the Albany Times-Union, the paper for which Ferrin's husband had worked, threatens a woman's death at a certain time, quote, during a shift change. It includes a cipher that, when decoded, makes reference to the Albany Medical Center being the location. Even more coincidentally, Good Times, the paper Gajkowski worked for starting in 1969, used Wednesday as its production day when staff would be inundated with work from morning until late at night. By the time the newspaper had folded in 1973, the Zodiac had mailed 15 letters believed to be authentic, and done so on every day of the week, except Wednesday. Furthermore, Gajkowski was trained as a medic in the Army, part of which included understanding how to utilize clothing for bandages in the field. He was taught how to tear shirts and use them for this purpose, and that the shirt tail, if tucked in, is considered the cleanest source of material. When San Francisco cab driver Paul Stein was gunned down by the killer, a swath was torn from the tail of his shirt in such an efficient manner that the Zodiac still had time to wipe down the cab and escape the scene without running. Oh, and about that murder, it happened on Washington Street, where Gajkowski's cousin lived. It also took place on October 11th, which was her birthday. Sounds a little ridiculous to be a birthday gift, right? Until you consider this was the only murder where the Zodiac possessed the ability to control its precise timing and location. It was in a cab. And one last note on that. The Good Times switchboard was only steps away from the murder on that same street, where Gajkowski lived. And while not evidence, it's probably worth mentioning that Paul Stein's sister identified Gajkowski as having attended her brother's funeral. In the summer of 1969, when three Bay Area newspapers each received one-third of that mysterious cipher from the Zodiac, Good Times ran its cover, split into thirds. Then, in 1971, right after the Zodiac sends a letter to the Los Angeles Times, which becomes its last communication for 3 years, Gajkowski is involuntarily admitted to a mental hospital after supposedly losing his marbles. When the Zodiac surfaces again in 1974, he strangely makes film references to The Exorcist as the best satirical comedy he's ever seen, and the Dirty Harry flick Badlands as a glorification of violence. That movie, of course, was somewhat attributed to the Zodiac's existence. Anyhow, at the time The Exorcist letter was sent, Gajkowski had already rejoined society as a film projectionist at a movie theater in San Francisco's Mission District. Plus, a dispatcher named Nancy Slover, who spoke to the Zodiac on the phone in 1969, claims Gajkowski's voice matches that of the killer. So, does any of this really add up to guilt? Is there anything lingering here about Richard Gajkowski, a.k.a. Dick Gajk, that seems to demand further explanation? Not really. You could pull files on any number of random murder cases and find striking coincidences that suggest somebody was a killer when, in fact, there simply is nothing physical to connect that person to the crime. But just how amazing can one coincidence be in the absence of corollary facts? I'll let you decide. You see, his name? It appears in the infamous three-part 408-character cipher the Zodiac sent to newspapers in the summer of 69 that claims to contain his identity. In the final segment of the cipher, we see the letters G-Y-K-E, Gajk, running consecutively through the middle of the block of symbols. Of course, this is one of Dick's nicknames, and also a pen name he wrote under. Moreover, when you translate these letters using the key devised to crack the code, it becomes apparent that G-Y-K-E then spells the back end of the word because with A-U-S-E. The word because, in the translated text, was part of the sentence where the killer says he will not reveal his name because the police will try to stop him from collecting slaves for his afterlife by killing. So Gajk, G-Y-K-E, translates to ouse, A-U-S-E, by using a decoding method that is routinely referred to as a key. Combine the three, as you had just combined the three sections of cipher, and you get Gajkowski. And we know the Zodiac also sent a 13-letter cipher to the cops that read, "My name is blank," followed by a 13-character cipher. The name Dick Gajkowski has 13 letters, as does Rich Gajkowski. Still, despite this revelation, Gajkowski has never garnered serious consideration from the police as a suspect. He was supposedly investigated by the Napa County Sheriff's Office, but they found no significant evidence to link him to the crimes. Some of his writings were considered to have been similar to the Zodiac, but he was ultimately excluded as a match. Richard Gajkowski finally died of cancer in San Francisco in 2004, and perhaps his secrets perished along with him. But he was not the killer. No, the Zodiac is this man. Arthur Lee Allen. Allen is widely considered the strongest known suspect in the case, but the card castle of circumstantial evidence that supports potential charges against him was essentially stamped null and void when in 2002, DNA evidence collected from the Zodiac's envelopes and stamps was not a match. In addition, bloody fingerprints lifted from Paul Stein's cab don't implicate Allen either. So he's innocent, right? Wrong. Lee Allen, as he was known in everyday life, didn't like to lick his own stamps or envelopes because he supposedly hated the taste of glue. And the bloody fingerprints on the taxi? There were witnesses to this crime who were on the scene before the police. It was a highly urban area, and it stands to reason that anyone who might have checked the inside of the cab to see if Stein was alive could have also contaminated the scene. It also could have been a cop too embarrassed to admit his blunder, in the same manner as Officer Don Falk waiting a month to admit he and his partner had encountered the Zodiac that night 3 minutes after the crime, only to let him go due to the inaccurate description of the subject being black. So, the evidence supporting Arthur Lee Allen as an innocent man beyond scrutiny, while physical, is truly no less circumstantial than the evidence suggesting he's guilty. And I think that's the intersection of fascination and frustration that has plagued and simultaneously fueled this case since day one. It's mesmerizing and circuitous, leaving interested parties wandering through the ocean of evidence like a ship lost at sea during a storm. So maybe that's a good place to start. Arthur Lee Allen's stint in the Navy. I think sometimes when the evidence seems to be pointing in every direction at once, it's best to step back and take a look at the suspect's life, as it pertains to what the person's mental state may have been at the time, depending upon certain life factors. When I do so with the inception of the Zodiac's crimes in 1968, it's easy to see the correlation to, and not to mention the culmination of, a downward spiral in Allen's personal and professional circumstances that might have caused him to finally go off the deep end, so to speak. In the late 1950s, Arthur Lee Allen is a student at Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo, well on his way to earning a bachelor's degree in elementary education. Aiming to impress his father, a proud military vet, Allen enlists in the Navy in 1957. But what seems to be developing into an accomplished life is soon marred by a number of missteps. In June 1958, Lee gets arrested for disturbing the police in Vallejo, and by December of the same year, he's less than honorably discharged from the Navy. So while he does ultimately get his degree and a job teaching elementary school at Travis Air Force Base, he's fired in 1963 for bringing a loaded gun to school. Before he can get back on his feet, he's severely injured in a motorcycle accident that essentially incapacitates him with a lacerated leg for the better part of the next few years. But in 1966, the man is hired by Valley Springs Elementary, where he taught until 1968, when he was fired for molesting a student. And this is where we pause, because Allen's life did the same. His teaching career was toast. He was broke, entering his 30s, and forced to move back in with his parents, a relationship described as mutually icy, relationships that likely had a profound effect on Allen's perception of authority, such as police, and his well-known misogynistic feelings toward his mother and hatred of women in general. It's around the same time that Lee's mother purchases him a Zodiac brand watch, complete with crosshair symbol, which he not only wears during a later face-to-face interview where he taunts police, but continues to flaunt for decades to come, despite the negative ramifications of doing so. In fact, it's alleged that the watch was given to Lee in December 1968, only days before the first killing at Blue Rock Springs, and just months before the killer contacts police and news media, introducing himself as the Zodiac. Now, Allen's brother claims that their mother gave Lee the watch in December of the previous year, but what remains true in the aftermath, regardless of whether it was 67 or 68, is that you end up with a disgruntled, 30-something ex-convict, specifically a molester with an interest in little girls and boys, living a lonely life in a makeshift apartment in his parents' basement. It was widely known that he drank heavily, and his former employers often noted so when questioned about him. So then, in January 1969, Allen reportedly has a conversation with an acquaintance, John Chaney, that later all but incriminates him as the Zodiac, to the extent the police make an unannounced visit to his workplace to grill him. Of course, let me preface Don Chaney's comments by saying that he was already privileged to information in the media by the time he came forward. And more importantly, it's known that his relationship with Lee ended when the man took a liking to his 13-year-old daughter, even driving her somewhere in his car without her father's permission. So, while Don Chaney runs his mouth about Arthur Lee Allen's incriminating statements, these are some of the finer points that pique the cop's interest. 1. He desires to kill couples at random. 2. He wants to send letters to the police that threaten schoolchildren. And finally, he was going to call himself Zodiac. By April of 1969, Lee's drinking problem costs him his job as a part-time attendant at a gas station in Vallejo where he'd worked since moving back in with his parents. So here we have a disgraced former military man turned shamed school teacher who obviously got a degree in elementary education so he could be closer to potential victims of his sexual advances, only to prove himself unworthy of working a gas pump part-time in the town where he grew up, and in the same house where his parents now kept him hidden in the darkness of their basement in shame. He's a heavy-set, balding, and now aging single male who is rapidly losing hope and burdened with the failure of his existence every time he sees his parents' disappointed faces staring back at him. So, 3 months later, Darlene Farron is brutally murdered at Lake Herman Road, and Michael Magoe, who was with her in the car, survives multiple gunshot wounds. I think what's perhaps most interesting about Magoe's story is not that he enthusiastically identified Arthur Lee Allen as the shooter in 1991, but the fact that 22 years passed before anybody had shown him a photo of the number one suspect in the case. That's just baffling. Of course, the introductory Zodiac letters start rolling into newspaper editors' offices only weeks later, and we suddenly have ourselves a serial killer. Notice that Allen, at this time, is drunk, unemployed, without romantic attachment, and at the top of my list, has nothing to look forward to. Translated, he's hopeless. And the cherry on top of this notion? He has nothing. Most importantly, not even an identity. That's right. He's so bogged down in this depression that he doesn't know who he is anymore. He failed in the Navy, then again as a teacher, and ultimately as a gas station attendant. More painful still, he failed as a son. He yearns for love at this time, perhaps even more than he ever has, but feels only rage in the absence of understanding how to truly seek it. He hopes for forgiveness, but drowns out the whispers with drink in the meantime. The voices in his head, and also the ones in his home, right upstairs, where they sometimes argue about him, where his father's health is failing before he'll ever have a chance to prove himself a worthy son, where his mother hates him, where his brother and sister no longer live because they've grown up and moved on, where the world doesn't understand. None of them. And there's nowhere to go from a place like that. So he goes inside. Inside his thoughts. Inside the secrets. Inside his rage. And that's where I believe Arthur Lee Allen became the Zodiac. But then something astonishing happens. Allen becomes employed as a part-time janitor in Vallejo. So my theory about the hopelessness leading to murder just got blown out of the water, right? Or did it? You see, he got a job during the 1969-1970 school year as a part-time janitor at an elementary school. Now, this might seem absolutely insane decades later, but sexual abuse was treated much differently back in those days. There was still a heavy stigma attached to molestation, but people who engaged in these things were sometimes just considered weird or oddballs with strange tastes. It was more so viewed as taboo rather than criminal, and employer background checks were certainly limited within that regard, among other considerations. Yet, what's really scary about this is not the man's potential for molestation, but the fact that the Zodiac starts threatening school children during this time, even writing to newspapers and police about bus bombs and picking off the kids one by one with a gun as they come off a bus that's been disabled by the shooter shooting out a tire. Of course, by the time the school year is a month underway, the Zodiac, on September 27, 1969, slaughters Cecilia Shepherd and nearly kills Brian Hartnell in a vicious stabbing attack where the serial murderer has finally adopted a terrifying uniform that further solidifies his new identity. The Zodiac is flying high at this point. He has the attention of everybody in the Bay Area, including police, the media, and scared teens. He's no less than a rock star. And suddenly Arthur Lee Allen doesn't seem so insignificant anymore, does he? No. You'd have to think a bit of this confidence would extend to his normal life back in the real world. And it did. He got the janitor's job where he could be surrounded by children again. And on October 6th, 1969, during that school year, Vallejo Police Department Detective John Lynch suddenly comes calling to question Lee about the killing of Cecilia Shepherd at Lake Berryessa just days earlier. Why is this so important? Because now it isn't just the Zodiac who's demanding attention. It's Lee. This is what a lot of people involved in this case fail to understand. Arthur Lee Allen did not taunt the police and bait them at every turn with more info than they needed because he was arrogant or a fool, but simply because he, as Arthur Lee Allen, needed to be recognized as the Zodiac. The Zodiac could not be a mystery forever, or he would have no identity. And just as his crimes had worked a terrifying perfection in their intentionally flawed nature, even sometimes leaving a dying victim to recount the true horror, Arthur Lee Allen played the police and news media like a fiddle the same way in his mesmerizing letters, postcards, and interviews. The same misspellings and childish jabs can be found throughout authenticated writings collected from Allen, even extending as far as a list of dinner recipes police confiscated from his home during a search. Words like programs become ploglams, and chicken cacciatore becomes chicken cacciatorious, while baked chicken with rice is spelled as blaked chicken lith lice. Sourpuss dead chicken is another example. So it was always plain as day that Lee was very much consistent with the Zodiac in his behavior, combining a crude but seemingly harmless and infantile sense of humor with a deep-seated rage hiding beneath. And finally, what the Zodiac clearly seemed to understand is that the police would ultimately get in the way of themselves and derail this investigation, as long as he let them. And he did. He cast a wide net across several jurisdictions and then tossed crumbs to the pigeons as they turned in circles trying to snatch them up before the next bird. So here we are on October 6th with Lee just having been questioned by a cop for the first time regarding the Barry Essam murders. He's officially on their radar at this point and never quite leaves. You have to figure that anybody, guilty or not, would be spooked by such a visit and subsequently keep a low profile, right? But what does Arthur Lee Allen do only 4 days later, on October 10th, 1969? He supposedly tells acquaintance Ralph Spinelli, with whom he previously had an altercation in 1958 that led to his arrest, that he's going to San Francisco to kill a cabbie. The next night, Paul Stein is shot and killed in his cab, and for the first time, the Zodiac took the victim's personal items to prove he was the killer. On a side note, it's interesting that Arthur Lee Allen and Paul Stein shared the same birthday, December 18th, and despite the sketch of the Zodiac drawn from the memories of three teen witnesses not matching Allen, the actual physical description they provide matches him almost perfectly. And I'll pause right here for a moment to recognize that this is officially the top of the mountain for the killer. He is already notorious, and then goes into a highly urban area and snuffs out a taxi driver, putting himself at such risk of being caught that he actually interacts with two cops right after the crime. He's no longer a legend, something to fear if you park your car on a shady dirt road in the middle of nowhere for a makeout session. No, he's among the people at this point, blending in, and what's even much stronger than that is the notion that this message sends to the entire San Francisco Bay Area. You are not safe. Not anywhere. And when the Chronicle receives the bloodied piece of Paul Stein's shirt shortly thereafter, the Zodiac's work is done. He's corroborated his identity with physical evidence, the last piece of the puzzle for making this real in Arthur Lee Allen's mind. He has truly cemented his identity in this world. And not only that, but he's ensured the fact that he'll never be forgotten. And at its foundation, isn't that simply what any of us wants? And with this, the Zodiac never kills again. There is nothing left to prove. Except to Lee's father, Ethan, the decorated Navy man who's fallen ill in his advanced years. He is still nothing in his father's eyes. So Lee enrolls in college again at Sonoma State, attending from 1970 to 74 and earning a bachelor's degree in biological science with a minor in chemistry. But his father passes away in 1971, before he obtains a job as a junior chemist at an oil refinery. Here we see a different Lee, one choosing his profession not for its proximity to children, and a man dedicated to caring for his mother in his later years. By the summer of that year, however, there's been a wave of momentum pushing the police in Lee's direction, due in part to a former acquaintance who said Lee made some incriminating claims in relation to the Zodiac murders. So SFPD detectives Armstrong and Toski contact Jack Mullinex at the Vallejo PD about getting more info on Allen before approaching the suspect. On August 4th, 1971, the three investigators show up at Allen's place of work unannounced and ask to speak with him. So, minutes later, Arthur Lee Allen enters the room, unaware he'll be meeting with the police. He just gets called in by his boss, who walks out and leaves him with the cops. And as the conversation begins, one of the investigators notices that Allen is wearing a Zodiac brand watch with the crosshair symbol on it. Lee goes on to claim, quote, "I'm not the Zodiac." But he also volunteers, without being prompted, that the reason he had bloody knives in his car on the day of the Lake Berryessa murders is because he killed a chicken. So it was assumed Sergeant John Lynch from the Vallejo PD had pressed Lee on this while questioning him months earlier. But Mullinex writes in his report that he contacts Lynch only to be told the Vallejo cop doesn't remember it happening. Allen then gives an alibi for the day of the Berryessa attacks, using a neighbor's name as being a witness to his whereabouts at the time. Except this neighbor, William White, just so happened to die a week after the murders. Beyond that, Lee provides two more witnesses that he claims he met at Treasure Island that day, but can't remember their names. He says he has them written down at home, but never follows up. Furthermore, Allen goes on to admit to liking guns and says the story The Most Dangerous Game, which was referenced in the translated 400A-character Zodiac cipher, made a lasting impression on him when he first read it. He finishes this circus by suggesting that he looks forward to the day that cops are no longer referred to as pigs. It leaves the investigators voting unanimously that the man definitely warrants a closer look. And with that, about 2.5 years pass before we hear any communication from the Zodiac again. So, had Lee finally kicked the habit and embraced a good, wholesome life? Not quite. In 1972, a search warrant is executed on Allen's property, only it's done so at a trailer he keeps in Santa Rosa rather than his home in Vallejo. The police come up empty on anything that would definitively tie him to the Zodiac crimes. But once again, the killer returns to communicating with the police by sending several letters in 1974. Then in August, Arthur Lee Allen is arrested on molestation charges and soon after begins a sentence at Atascadero State Hospital, a mental institution where he was previously employed. From here, it's mostly downhill for Lee, as he's released in 1977 and is forced to piece together a meager living doing various jobs over the next 15 years, including working at a hardware store and assisting senior citizens. In 1991, however, the Vallejo PD executes a search warrant against Allen's home, and by this time his mother Bernice has passed away. Inside, they find numerous weapons and diagrams for constructing bombs, but supposedly nothing that incriminates him in the Zodiac killings. Which is odd because they recovered a foot-long knife with metal rivets in a sheath, like the one that had been used to stab Brian Hartnell and Cecilia Shepherd at Lake Berryessa. Police reports also indicated Allen wore a size 10.5 boot, which matches the size of an impression left by the Zodiac at that same crime. Even more interesting, Arthur Lee Allen is supposedly so enraged by the fact that he's being implicated in this crime that he actually holds a press conference. And at that point, we can see another correlation to Lee wanting to deny being the Zodiac while also being recognized as the Zodiac. If he was so angry at the police pointing him out as being this person, he certainly did not help himself by going on TV and doing the same. So, in this search, again, what else did they find? The same type of ammunition used to kill the young lovers at Lake Herman Road. And he also had a Royal typewriter that matched the one suspected in writing the confession letters that Sherry Jo Bates' killer sent. As an aside, I also want to mention that Arthur Lee Allen only missed one day of work as an elementary school teacher in the 1960s, out of 19 available sick days. It was November 1st, 1966, just 2 days after Sherry Jo Bates' murder. Yet, even with all this circumstantial evidence, the police have nothing concrete on their suspect, So not only does he walk, but as a two-time felon already, or a felon already, he inexplicably doesn't receive any charges for owning a stockpile of guns. Plus, the bomb plants he has match the Zodiacs in that they threaten to utilize ammonium nitrate, fertilizer, and gravel. Again, no charges are filed on this front either. But in July 1992, more than two decades after the attack of Blue Rock Springs, this is when survivor Michael McGough finally identifies Arthur Lee Allen in a police photo lineup as the man who shot him and Darlene Farron that dreadful night. Yet, while police are finally armed with some significant evidence, Arthur Lee Allen passes away a month later, in August of 92, at the age of 58, from complications due to diabetes and heart disease. Guilty or not, he would never face justice in this case. 2 days later, however, the Vallejo PD executes another search warrant on his home, this time the gold at the end of the rainbow being a purported videotape in Allen's possession that was labeled with a Z. It's not publicly known what appeared on this tape, but we can assume it was not incriminating to the extent that it implicated Arthur Lee Allen as the Zodiac. But isn't it funny that the evidence found in his home reflects everything else the Zodiac did, in the sense that it pointed to him as the killer, but never definitively? Lee was never innocent, and yet never quite guilty either. And you know what, folks? I think that's just how he would have wanted it to end, with all of us still wondering, but fearing the truth in our hearts, which is that the Zodiac is still collecting slaves for his afterlife. And as long as the case remains unsolved, we'll have books, movies, and podcasts fully dedicated to this plight. And that's what's truly scary about the Zodiac. 50 years later, he's still in control.